This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night in New Orleans, L.A. Lakers guard Kobe Bryant became only the second player in NBA history to score at least 50 points in four consecutive games. College-wise, if you were playing favorites, you had the brackets right, at least if we're considering the men's games played last night. In that NCAA action, number one seed Florida beat number five Butler, number three Oregon knocked off number seven UNLV, number two seed Georgetown squeaked by number six Vanderbilt by a point, and number one North Carolina showed their tarry heels to number five USC. This afternoon, number two seed Memphis will try to reverse that trend against number one Ohio State, and this evening, number one Kansas will play number two UCLA. At noon today, in the women's tournament, Bowling Green and Arizona State will play in Greensboro, North Carolina, where Duke, a number one seed, will try to fend off number four seed Rutgers at 2 p.m. This evening, Louisiana State University will play Florida State, and number one Connecticut will face North Carolina State. But perhaps the most intriguing women's game of the weekend will find Pat Summitt's Tennessee Volunteers playing the Red Foxes of Marist College at noon tomorrow. Marist College is a number 13 seed. The Red Foxes earned the unlikely opportunity to play Tennessee by dumping Ohio State and Middle Tennessee, results that no doubt surprised a lot of people. Marist College head coach Brian Georges is not among them. When Georges got the Marist job 4 years ago, the move was minimally disruptive. He'd been coaching high school sports at Our Lady of Lourdes, which, like Marist, is located in Poughkeepsie, New York. At the high school level, the basketball team's coach Georges led built a record of 451 wins and just 44 losses, nearly Summit-like numbers. Joining me now on the line is Brian Georges, who will be trying to coach the Marist women to their third tournament upset tomorrow at noon. Coach, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me on.
So, how hard is it to keep your team from looking past Tennessee to that potential matchup with Oklahoma?
Well, one thing we've been very good at is not looking past people. but obviously, if you look past Tennessee, then you might be North Carolina or Duke or UConn, but not Marist.
This week, you were quoted in the New York Times as saying that you hadn't figured out how to beat the Volunteers yet, but you were working on it. Have you got a plan?
Well, we've got multiple plans because that's a team where if plan A doesn't work, and it probably won't, we need a plan B and a plan C to try to beat them.
But you're not going to tell me Marist is just happy to be there.
No, not at all. No, as exciting as all of this has been and stuff like that, we're going in there trying to advance to the Elite Eight.
You were a high school basketball coach with a record of 451-44 over 19 seasons and four consecutive state titles, and apparently you're the only high school coach to lead teams in four different sports to the New York State Final Four. This includes a softball state title. Why did Our Lady of Lourdes High School let you go from one side of Poughkeepsie to the other?
Well, the interesting story with that is, in our Catholic high schools, you don't make a lot of money. And when they saw my contract, Sister Lois said, Brian, you've done everything here, and we can't thank you enough, but you need to go try this to see if you can do it, because it's something that I'd always wanted to do. And she said the magic words, and if it doesn't work out, we'll take you back.
So there's always room for you back at Our Lady of Lourdes.
Yeah.
I love it.
They're wonderful people. I mean, you can't believe how great those people are at Lourdes. And I didn't think I could ever find another, colleagues that would be as good as that. But I found the same type of people here.
At Marist, basketball had been floundering for a decade before you arrived 4 years ago. But since a losing first season, the Red Foxes have been 94-30. How do you turn a program around so quickly at a mid-major school?
I think a lot of it really deals with the players and buying into what you do. And I think in this day and age where you have a lot of people with egos, fortunately, we have kids who believe in a team philosophy. I think you need leadership, and we have a great senior point guard, who has just a wonderful refuse-to-lose attitude and has always been a winner. And I was fortunate enough to have a few of my kids from Lourdes who came over here also and, kind of helped with the other kids who may not have been buying into the philosophy first. And when the kids started to see that it could be successful, you've got a lot of people on the same page, and that always helps.
You know, Coach, even as we speak, somebody is talking to Pat Summitt about, kids buying into the philosophy and the team ethic and the rest. I wonder, are you acquainted with Coach Summitt?
When you're out on the road recruiting, sometimes you're sitting next to him, and she's always very nice. I met her once in 2001 when my family was on a reunion-type thing down in Dollywood, and I went up, and you know, she actually came in a couple hours later, and you know, I had an audience, what I call it, because she's kind of like the Pope. But I had a nice meeting with her, and you know, I was just in awe. And, you know, she autographed a picture for me because I'm a huge autograph collector, and her picture has been in my office since the day I took this job.
When your team returned to Poughkeepsie on Wednesday, big reception occurred, and not just a reception from the community of the college. ESPN, the New York Times, offbeat public radio sports programs like ours, all wanting to talk to you. Is it surreal having this much attention paid?
Oh, extremely. I mean, you knew there were a lot of media outlets, but you didn't know they'd all converge at once. And I tease my SID. I said, maybe we should get a deli counter out here, and you know, oh, number 39, you know, number 40. It's just been a whirlwind of stuff, and you know, like I say, it's been wonderful because you know it helped get the Marist name out there, and people, you know, hopefully are getting on online and checking out our school, you know, not just to play basketball, but to see what a wonderful school it really is.
Brian Georges is the head coach of the Marist Red Foxes. Brian, thank you and good luck tomorrow.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The Orlando Magic reached the 1995 NBA Finals on the strong play of then-newcomer Shaquille O'Neal, but since O'Neal's 1996 departure from Orlando, the Magic haven't approached that level of success. Now the Magic are aiming for their first playoff berth in 4 years, and as Ron Schachter reports, the team has once again placed its hopes on a promising young center.
At the end of December, the Orlando Magic owned second place in the NBA East and seemed headed for their first winning season since 2003. But over the past 3 months, the team has lost almost two-thirds of its games and is scrambling with the Pacers, Nets, and Knicks for the final two playoff spots in the conference. Last night's win at home against the New Jersey Nets left Orlando with a 32-38 one-loss record. Brian Schmitz covers the Magic for the Orlando Sentinel.
They started out 13-4, and everybody thought, wow, this is going to be the season they put together, built great expectations, and then injuries, inconsistencies, they just have not been able to put it together, and they're trying to make the kind of run they did at the end of last season to try to get in the playoffs. And this town is really hungry to try to get back into the postseason.
Guard Grant Hill has been at the heart of Orlando's hopes and frustrations ever since he arrived 6 years ago from Detroit, where he averaged better than 22 points a game in six All-Star seasons with the Pistons. The Magic have won fewer than half their games on Hill's watch. But the most remarkable statistic he's recorded with the team, says Schmitz, is the nearly 300 games he's missed.
Well, Grant has just been cursed ever since he's been here. 2000, obviously five ankle surgeries. Last season had the hernia surgery. He could have retired years ago, and all his contract is guaranteed, so he just could have sat on his wallet. But every year, from every injury, he's rehabbed, tried to play again. And a couple years ago, he made it back to the All-Star game. It's interesting because a lot of people in town, you know, they've kind of turned on him a little bit because they kind of felt that he's been the albatross on this franchise's back.
Now in the last year of his contract, Hill has been sidelined at various times by knee and foot injuries, and his 14-point scoring average is the lowest of his career. And while he's still the team leader, the Magic are depending on a core of young players to carry them to the playoffs. 21-year-old Dwight Howard, already in his third season, is averaging a team-leading 18 points and 12 rebounds a game, and is widely regarded as the NBA's next dominant center. Magic coach Brian Hill, who once coached a young Shaquille O'Neal here, says that Howard is drawing comparisons, as well as the attention of opposing teams.
Dwight is, I think, developing into one of the best low-post players in the game right now. And, you know, he still has a ways to go. He's still learning, you know, handling all the double team situations and everything else. But Dwight's going to get double teamed pretty much every time he touches the ball.
Beyond his own personal development, the soft-spoken Howard is concerned about recapturing what drove the team earlier in the season.
I think it was just, you know, the confidence we had in each other and the chemistry. You know, when some of our players went down, you know, I think the confidence level dropped in, you know, some of the team. And also the chemistry, you know, kind of disappeared. You know, but we're slowly gaining it back.
Howard and 21-year-old Darko Milicic, a 7-footer acquired from Detroit in the offseason, have emerged as a shot-blocking tandem on defense. And rookie and former Duke star J.J. Redick has seen his playing time and scoring increase and is developing into one of Orlando's guards of the future. Now the Magic are focusing on the 12 regular season games they have left. Guard Jameer Nelson sees little margin for error.
Every game, like I keep saying from here on out, is a challenge for us, you know, no matter who it is. You got teams fighting to try to get in, teams fighting to stay in the playoffs. We're on the outside looking in, and we have to be that much more focused, that much more aggressive during the course of the games. Right now, we can't let things slip through our hands anymore.
The Magic's uneven performance this season is a mystery to veteran Grant Hill, who's still hoping to script a happy ending.
We were just playing winning basketball. You know, we had a confidence. We didn't care who scored or who got the glory. Not, you know, just went out there and, okay, what do we have to do tonight to win? And I'm not saying we're not doing that now, but the frustrating thing for me and I guess for all of us is just trying to kind of figure out, okay, what's exactly happened? You know, now we still have a chance moving forward to try to finish right and position ourselves for the postseason, but it's just been a weird season that I can't quite figure out.
While last night's win against the Nets helped, Monday night's game in New York against the Knicks and next Friday's contest at home with the Indiana Pacers will have a big impact on the Magic's postseason prospects. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Orlando.
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, an NBA agent shows the big money to a skinny, no-talent center. But first, Only a Game's Monica Brady-Meyeroff reported 3 weeks ago on Earth Race, the biodiesel boat which set out on March 10th to break the world circumnavigation record. Just hours into the race, the crew experienced propeller and engine problems. Not long after repairs were made, Earth Race collided with a small skiff carrying three fishermen early Sunday morning off the coast of Guatemala. Of the two fishermen who were rescued by the crew, one was hospitalized with serious injuries but is expected to recover. The third is missing and presumed drowned. The crew now finds itself awaiting a court appearance while their vessel remains under military guard in Puerto Quetzal. Last summer, a stranger walked into USC basketball coach Tim Floyd's office and asked, "How would you like to have the best player in the country?" And so began one of the more bizarre recruiting stories in the annals of college basketball. Joining me now on the line is Lee Jenkins, whose story about how O.J. Mayo became a USC Trojan appeared in the New York Times this week. Lee, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Some of our listeners may not be familiar with O.J. Mayo. Tell us a little bit about what he did that made him such a catch.
Well, this guy's really probably considered the best high school basketball player in the country. He's one of these prep standouts who's compared every year to the likes of LeBron James. If the NBA didn't have a limitation on high school seniors forcing them to go to college for a year, he would almost certainly be going right to the NBA. He'd be drafted in the top 10 picks. He would be seen as a player who can change a franchise. So when he's going to college, basically every major college in the country is thinking, if I can get this guy, he can help my team win a national championship. We'll probably only have him for 1 year, and then he'll go pro. But it's still considered a huge coup to get a player of that caliber.
Well, as you say, the coaches of the most powerful basketball teams, college basketball teams in the country, knew all about this guy. Why had Tim Floyd at USC not bothered to recruit him?
Well, because he thought he had no chance. Tim Floyd had been on the job for about 18 months when he first had contact with O.J. Mayo. And when you're going after a supreme talent like that, most coaches are in the gym when they're in ninth grade, even eighth grade, you know, conveying their interest, letting them know, you know, we're on you early, hoping that that loyalty is reciprocated.
But O.J. Mayo, through an intermediary, initiated contact with the coach. Tell us about that day.
He was in his office one day, and a man he did not know came into the office and said, as you indicated earlier, how would you like to have the best player in the country play for you? I think he thought the guy was a total nut. You know, he said, why aren't you at school like Arizona or Connecticut? And the man said that Mayo wanted to play in Los Angeles because he felt that the marketing opportunities would help him once he jumped to the NBA, which he'll inevitably do after a year and 2 years at most. And so Floyd then said, well, why aren't you at UCLA? UCLA, of course, being one of the premier programs in college basketball. And the man said no. He shook his head. He said UCLA has already won their championships. They've already produced their stars. And Mayo sort of wants to come and make his mark. And by the end of the day, O.J. Mayo had given his commitment to USC. It's wild when you think of all these schools spending 4 and 5 years recruiting these kids, and USC apparently able to get it done with the best player in the country in one day.
I love the fact that this man who approached Coach Floyd on O.J. Mayo's behalf said, you can't have O.J.'s phone number, he'll call you. How often does an arrangement like that happen between player and head coach?
Well, I think it shows just how big time this player is. That is one of those tales that probably will live on, that this kid wouldn't even give out his cell phone number. But, you know, most of the young basketball players in the country would love a coach at a school like USC to have his phone number, to call him.
What I want to know is, how did USC get to be better even before this kid arrived? Was there sort of an osmosis of talent that transferred to the current team, even though this kid isn't on campus yet? He's just out of high school?
Well, I mean, this was already an athletic team and already had some good players, but I think that some of the players probably bought into their coach a little more. Saw, well, you know, this guy was able to attract O.J. Mayo. We should listen to him. And I think they were probably listening.
Even though he didn't attract O.J. Mayo.
Right.
Mayo came to him.
Well, he still attracted him just by being there, I guess. But so it's probably a little bit of a stretch, but I know Floyd felt as though it helped this year's team in some intangible way.
Now, my understanding is O.J. Mayo also took some of the burden of recruiting off the coach's shoulders, said something like, Coach, don't worry about recruiting, I'll take care of it.
Yeah, no, that's part of what makes it more of a wild tale. And recruiting stories are always wild. But what made this interesting, I think, was sort of Mayo's gumption on the phone and the way he talked to Floyd and the way he was able to say, don't worry about recruiting, I'll take care of it, because Mayo has so many friends on these AAU circuits. He was able to help lure one of his good friends, Devon Jefferson, another talented recruit. He was able to steer him to USC. So the Trojans next year are going to have Mayo and Jefferson, and those two may be a handful, but they are extremely talented.
Now, O.J. Mayo's basketball talent notwithstanding, and I have no doubt at all that he's a genuine blue chipper, as you've described, he doesn't come without baggage. He leads the league in, among other things, high schools attended, right?
Right. Yeah, he's really bounced around. West Virginia to Kentucky to Ohio, back to West Virginia. Those stints were marred by some suspensions. He is a high-maintenance superstar.
So then the question is, how does the admissions department at USC feel about these developments?
Well, I think USC is one of those huge athletic departments that's used to making concessions and sacrifices for star athletes. And this is the world we live in. You make sacrifices for star athletes who can bring attention and exposure to your school in other ways. You know, just as I'm sure if an admissions representative was on the line, they would say we would make a sacrifice for a world-class pianist also who brought another dimension to our campus. I don't know if...
Especially if he could bring a great fiddler with him.
Exactly. Well put.
Lee Jenkins writes about sports for the New York Times. Lee, thank you again.
Thank you, Bill. Take care.
For 26 years, Keith Glass has represented pro basketball players. His greatest achievement may have been forcing the Houston Rockets to pay reserve center Chuck Nevitt $350,000 for weighing 257 pounds, even though Nevitt was no longer employed by the Rockets. Joining me from the studios of NPR in Washington now to explain how he accomplished that and various other wonders is Keith Glass, the author of Taking Shots, Tall Tales, Bizarre Battles, and The Incredible Truth About the NBA. Mr. Glass, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Let us jump right to the aforementioned Chuck Nevitt and the weight clause least likely to appear in an NBA contract ever again, shall we?
Yes, I think they've eliminated the loopholes there. Chuck Nevitt and I negotiated a contract with the Houston Rockets, and they didn't want to guarantee him 3 years. They only wanted to guarantee him 2 years. Now, Bill, between me and you, why they guaranteed him 1 year, I have no idea. But once they got to two, I had to try to get him to three. And when I asked them, what's the problem with the third year? They said, Keith, he's so skinny. We're afraid he can't gain weight. He can't sustain it. And he's going to get pushed around. So I said, okay, look, here's what we'll do. If he gains 20 pounds a year, the third year will become guaranteed. And they went along with that. So he had to weigh 255, I think, in order to get a $350,000 third year. Okay, no problem. Three games into the first year, they realized what I had realized all along was that Chuck was not a great player. And they released him. Now, 6 months later, I called them and said, where's the weigh-in? And they go, what weigh-in? I said, Chuck Nevitt's weighing. You know, I got a third year coming here. They said, Keith, we don't care what he weighs. We haven't seen him in a half a year. I said, well, I don't care whether you've seen him or not. He's still a human being, and he's gaining weight. In fact, he's eating pasta as we're talking. He made it up to 257. His wife kept feeding him Italian food. And I had to arbitrate, and we won. And people thought that was, you know, that I was, you know, snookering everybody. But I thought it was very clear. We didn't want to be released. We didn't want to be waived. We were ready to play.
We were ready to eat.
We were ready to eat. We were ready to do what they asked us to do.
Well, it's a little ironic that you celebrate your role in the Chuck Nevitt affair, because elsewhere in Taking Shots, you maintain that the NBA is completely out of whack in terms of what players are paid. Aren't you at least partially responsible for the current state of affairs?
I am exactly 4% responsible, because that's what we charge. The public thinks it's 10. I wish it was. My wife wishes it was, but it's not. And absolutely, I'm part of the problem. The only thing that makes it easier for me is to realize that I have been saying the same things that are in this book for 10 or 15 years. I think we have gotten way out of whack. But it's not just agents. It's not just the NBA. It's the media, it's the NCAA, it's AAU coaches, it's sneaker companies, it's interfering parents, it's all the way up and down the line. It's like it's a cesspool that just happened to bubble up to the top, which is the NBA. It's not all the NBA's fault, but it's certainly at their feet now.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a minute. You say today's NBA players make too much money, which leads them to feel entitled, your word, but one that's been tossed around by lots of folks. But how are those players different from the most successful movie stars, singers, the country's 10,000 most highly compensated business executives, or for that matter, the most successful agents?
I don't think they are. People now are trying to make this, like the problems with the NBA, a race issue. There is a color involved here. It's not black and it's not white and it's green. When you look at the amounts of money in the hands of very, very young people, it is going to only attract problems. And I think that the money issue, rather than just a lack of character or it being indigenous to one race or the other, is ridiculous. It's an unnatural infusion of money into the human body.
One of the sadder stories in your book concerns Thomas Hamilton, a 7-foot-4-inch player whom you represented as he tried out for several teams. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Hamilton.
It is a sad story. What happened with Tommy was he came to me as a 19-year-old. He called me collect on the phone. Tommy told me he was 7'4", and he was 370 pounds. And when I checked with sources in Chicago, which is where he was from, they had told me that he was the best prospect, the best big prospect that they had ever seen. That got my interest. I'm an agent. You know, whatever else I'm going to say, that 4% starts dangling in my head, too. I'm human. By the time I flew him out to New Jersey to meet with him, which was only 4 days later, he was 406. When I saw him, he could hardly move, and it was my goal to try to get him back in shape, which we did. I got him with Isaiah Thomas to Toronto. We got him down to 328. He was phenomenal. And Isaiah Thomas, who was the president, allowed him to go back to Chicago to visit. And 3 weeks later, he was 408. And make a long story short, he sort of ate himself out of the league, I guess. And I tried to get a hold of him to, you know, to update my chapter, but I couldn't find him. I heard he's still in the projects where he grew up in Chicago, and that was the end of Tommy.
You mention in the book that in retrospect, you see that Thomas Hamilton may have been manic depressive and that he might have been better off receiving medical treatment rather than trying to catch on with a pro basketball team. Why do you suppose that nobody, including you, saw that this young man was in real trouble at that time?
Well, you know, somebody like me, my interaction with Tommy after the initial trying to get him in shape is by phone. You know, no one spends as much time with any basketball player than his family did when he was growing up, than anybody would, teachers, coaches, that kind of thing. So, you know, that I guess that's not our job. In a perfect world, it would be. But, you know, we're in a tough business, Bill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're trying to make money. They're trying to win games. I'm on a percentage. Let's be honest about it. I'm not Pollyanna.
My guest is Keith Glass, author of Taking Shots. You're listening to Only a Game. One of the themes that you return to several times in the book is what you call the sad state of basketball in this country today. To what extent is that assessment based on the performance of the U.S. team at the 2004 Olympic Games?
Not that much of it is an assessment of that. The Olympic Games, to me, were just a horror show and was the culmination of all the things that I'm talking about in the book. The selfishness that I see. See, when I look at the state of basketball, I look at an NBA game, especially a regular season NBA game, and it's just tedious and it's boring because it's selfish. And the reason it's selfish, in my opinion, it always gets back to money. But we're not creating basketball players anymore. We're creating stars. Somewhere 10, 12 years ago, the directive came down from the league office, apparently. We're not a sport. We're not here to have kids and young adults play together, learn together, grow together, work together for a common goal, as corny as that sounds. We're here to entertain. The players have bought into that. There is nothing that they do that is not geared to entertaining fans. And until we get back and stop accepting that nonsense and get back to it being a sport, we're not going to be able to set the tone as we have before. And more important than that, what are we teaching down below? And that's my major concern. The NBA people, I'm not worried about. They're making insane amounts of money. I'm making 4% off of that. We should have our pictures on post office walls, for crying out loud. I'm not worried about us. I'm worried about the message that you send down below.
And the way you put that message in the book, you maintain that the current system evident in pro basketball, quote, can destroy our culture. And I don't just mean in the NBA. Boy, even for an agent, that sounds like quite an overstatement.
Yeah, well, maybe it is, but at least it's got you talking. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Keith Glass is the author of Taking Shots, Tall Tales, Bizarre Battles, and the Incredible Truth About the NBA. It's published by HarperCollins. He joined me from the studios of NPR in Washington. Keith, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Pittsburgh hits me with its best shots. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hey, Charlie.
Right now. Hang on.
It's been a long series of nights with this NCAA tournament.
That's exactly the problem. The best game on Thursday night went until, you know, well past midnight.
The games on Thursday night also saw Kansas and Ohio State just barely survive. What's in store for them as the tournament rolls along?
Well, I think that Ohio State's got to find some way to keep Greg Oden in the game. Single-digit scoring from him is not going to cut it. And Kansas has just got an enormous amount of talent and got hooked up with exactly the wrong team. I mean, we can all, those of us interested in the aesthetics of things, and I don't want to hear about how much we don't like pitchers' duels in baseball, should be just as happy that Southern Illinois is out of the tournament because, boy, are they hopeless to watch.
What about on the women's side, Charlie? Which games will you be watching this weekend?
Well, we got to watch the Marist Lady Red Foxes continue, don't we? I mean, this is a great story of trouble and woe. You've got LSU considering to proceed through the tournament with all the crazy and nasty gymnastiness trailing behind it. And then you've got a lot of strangers in the brackets on the women's side this year, which is good to see. You've got Hofstra playing. You've got Bowling Green playing. You've got George Washington. And as we mentioned, Marist. My big problem with the women's tournament has always been that the chalk seemed to hold more obviously than it did on the men. That's not the case this year.
Tubby Smith is no longer Tubby the Wildcat. He's now Tubby the Gopher, headed for Minnesota. You think he'll have success there?
Well, I think he'll be happier there. He's leaving the land of crazy people and going to a place where people are crazy only about ice hockey and high school ice hockey at that. That's a job with some potential. It's a Big Ten school. It's been successful at basketball before. You know, call Kevin McHale if you want further details. And I certainly, Tubby Smith will be more at ease there. Of course, this opens up the festival of cutthroats, brigands, and pirates for the Kentucky job, which will be amusing as we go along.
I'm not entirely familiar with the NBA's arcane regulations, Charlie. Explain to me why Danny Ainge, the Boston Celtics executive director of basketball operations, was fined $30,000 for chatting amiably with the woman in the seat next to him at the Big 12 college basketball tournament.
Because the woman in the seat next to him was the mother of Kevin Durant at the University of Texas, who may well be a Boston Celtic this time next year. These are rules I get the feeling the NBA is making up as they go along. I mean, I know it's part of the coordinated effort between the NBA and NCAA to make one product out of basketball, but this really seems high. I can't fathom the advantage that Danny Ainge would have gained by sitting next to Mother Durant at these games.
Yankees general manager Brian Cashman declared this week that he will not offer a contract extension to Alex Rodriguez, and in a related story, the Sultan of Brunei would like to borrow $20. A contract extension?
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting story as the entire baseball season goes along. The Yankees pretty plainly don't want to keep him in New York. A-Rod pretty plainly doesn't want to wind up, you know, God knows where. He doesn't want to be in New York. The Yankees don't want him to stay there. Unfortunately, he has to stay there. The Yankees have now made it plain they're not going to do anything extra special to get him to stay there. So A-Rod will be his usual cheery presence in the clubhouse for 162 games this year.
In a shocking development,
no!
Several WWE,
don't say it!
Several,
I'm not listening. No,
several
no, no, no,
WWE
no, 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 no,
wrestlers have been linked to the ongoing nationwide steroids investigation. The shock, I suppose, is that all the WWE wrestlers haven't been linked to that investigation.
Yeah, we're talking about two or three guys. I don't think our FBI is working anywhere near hard enough.
Last week, we mentioned the most recent ranking of the U.S. men's soccer team, Charlie. I guess it's only fair we should mention that the women's team has also been re-ranked this week. No crooked numbers for them, huh?
They're number one.
Absolutely.
They're number one. They're number one. First time since 2003, and good for them.
Charlie, this week I learned of still another sport besides pro wrestling, skydiving, and ultramarathoning that I would never be tempted to try. Let us talk of last weekend's open water swimming championships in Melbourne, Australia.
Well, I mean, there are problems with any sport. There are hockey players whose career end because of abdominal injuries. They can't skate anymore. I don't have to go into all the things that can go wrong in NASCAR. Open water swimming seems to have a serious problem with, wait for it, jellyfish, which do not get out of the way to celebrate the World Open Water Swimming Champion. And practically everyone competing in the World Open Water Swimming Championship in Melbourne got stung to within an inch of whatever it is you can get stung of.
Boxing promoter Don King was spotted this week walking through St. Peter's Square, waving the flags of Italy and of the Vatican. I didn't know that the Vatican had a flag, but now I do because Don King waved it, and I don't know why, beyond the fact that it was there.
Only in the Vatican! Yes, when you thought that reality couldn't get weirder, he was in the audience for Pope Benedict XVI's general audience. Can I just say there's no truth to the rumor that from now on, whenever the Pope appears on the balcony, someone's going to stand behind him holding up a belt.
Finally, Charlie, the dreams of those hoping to land Manny Ramirez's grill are cooked. Why is that?
Well, because it was a fake auction. There's Manny trying to make a couple of extra farthings on the eBay, as the kids say, and he puts his used grill on there. And things get bid right along, and then some idiot has to bid $100 million. Let's presume this isn't authentic.
Do you suppose it was Alex Rodriguez?
I did like the offer, though. The one offer that was for $5,111.11, which, if you move the decimal points around, is the $51.11 million that the Sox offered for the rights to negotiate for Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Rumble, young Pope, rumble!
Hot barbecue today!
It is a Saturday afternoon, and I am in Pittsburgh, and I am meeting Jimmy Savetic at his gym at the corner of 3rd Avenue and Ross, except that the cab driver is saying there is no gym at 3rd and Ross, and sitting in the cab, it seems he is correct. And I am wondering why I am in Pittsburgh in late February anyway, which is not such a good time to be many places, but especially Pittsburgh. Then this guy comes out of the door of a place that is closed and is not a gym, and he is moving toward me like a little truck, and he is Jimmy Savetic, who explains why the cab driver is confused no little and quite some.
3rd Avenue Cafe, and it's about the boxing gym, and it's a place where we build champions in life.
Some modest champion building is going on, even as Jimmy Savetic tells me about the process. A guy who used to train in the gym downstairs is painting the ceiling of the cafe, meaning that Jimmy will pay him enough so that the guy and the daughter he's raising by himself will have rent money. The walls of the cafe are jammed with photographs of Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali, Rocky Marciano, and other champions. Halfway through a tour he's giving me, Savetic, who was a police officer and a homicide detective in Allegheny County for more than 30 years before he retired to the cafe, the gym, and various promotional schemes, stops in front of a photo of Roberto Duran, whom Jimmy admires because Duran could skip rope in a squatting position, and for at least one other reason.
You know, this is the only guy I know in boxing and knocked the guy's wife out. When he was first started out, he knocked the guy out, and the woman came in and jumped on his back. He knocked her out.
This is during a fight?
After the fight. After he knocked the guy out, she came in after the fight. He dumped the wife.
Besides the boxers, there are old photographs of legendary pickpockets on one wall of the cafe, a dubious lot, and a poster featuring the poet, Charles Bukowski, and more.
Here, my most favorite pitcher in the house, Cyril Weck. Now, if you don't know who Cyril Weck is, then you don't know anything about homicides. He's the one that first called the Kennedy assassination a conspiracy. And he's right now in retirement because they're saying that he did something wrong. I just know I like him, and I just find him a pretty cool guy in Pittsburgh.
Jimmy and I end our tour at the door, which leaves us nowhere to go but out, and then down the steps to the gym. Even as gyms go, this place is humble. There's room for a ring that's maybe 14 by 14 feet, a heavy bag, some free weights. If one of the boxers were to drop to do push-ups, anybody going anywhere else in the room would have to step over or around him. Inside the ropes, a heavyweight whom Jimmy calls Slava is shadowboxing.
He come down here to the gym.
Yeah.
Now, he came in here and said, I want you to train me. I said, oh, God, let me guess. He's the next great white hope. Well, he came from Russia, Ukraine, Russia.
Russia.
Russia, Russia. And he came down and hit the bag. Almost fell down the steps watching him hit the bag. He's that good.
He's certainly that big. Slava is 22, and he claims he was successful as an amateur in Russia.
I got 35, 28, 1, 2 lost. Yeah, and
So then I moved over here with my parents and stuff. I always wanted to do boxing, but my coach, the first coach over here, he told me to come down to this gym and talk to Jimmy about if I can training or whatever.
So what's next?
What's next? Try and turn pro, be a world champion.
Further conversation with Slava is precluded by work, his, not mine. Jimmy has arranged for somebody to climb into the ring with the heavyweight and hold the padded mitts with which trainers feel the fighter's punches.
I'm going to bring in the Khan. He was in prison for 20 years. He's going to hold the badge for the communists.
The Khan, to whom Jimmy Savedic refers, is actually an ex-con, a slender black man of 62 named Mehdi Muhammad, though Jimmy prefers to continue knowing him as Larry Chisholm, or Chiz.
But old Chiz, now we have a history. We're connected at the hip.
I grew up on the Hill District area of Pittsburgh, which is one of the highest crime rate areas in the city. Since I was a kid, I spent nearly 48 years of my life in and out of prisons, institutions, out of 62. Not something I'm proud of, but that's the way it was. For the most part, I started boxing when I was 10, 11. And when I reached the age of 25, I was... had accomplished so much in boxing that I was ready for a title shot with a gentleman out of Philadelphia named Matthew Saad Muhammad, light heavyweight. And because I was out with some friends celebrating in the car with the wrong people at the wrong time with the wrong thing in the car, which was a lot of drugs, we got arrested. And
that was that.
When I got back out, I was 35 years old, 10 to 20 years. And that went on and on and on.
At 51, Mehdi Muhammad decided he'd had enough of jail. He began supporting anti-gang initiatives and working with Jimmy Savedic to encourage youngsters to confine their fighting to the gym. And now, here he was, set to climb into the ring with a man of 22.
Are you going to get in the ring with this guy?
Yes, I'm going to work with him.
Yeah, all right. You're giving away 40-odd years here.
It's a 62-year-old chronologically, but we're talking about a 25-year-old body. Unlike Jimmy.
There's a thin line between the cop and the con. Really is. I got good breaks in my life, or I could easily fell that way. And if he would have got the breaks, he'd have been a great cop. And that's the truth. And then anybody, you know, I met a lot of guys that I went to prison. A hell of a lot more honest than a lot of the people that I met, supposedly they're supposed to be the great pillars of our society.
The ex-cop, the ex-con, and the ex-communist are all men, of course. This gym is essentially a man's place, or a place for boys aspiring to manhood, as Jimmy Savedic defines the term. But on this particular day, perhaps in order to provide me with a fuller sense of his own marvelously varied endeavors, Jimmy has invited a card girl to drop by. The function of a card girl, well, Nikki herself can explain.
Basically, it's at the end of every round, just going and letting everybody know what's going on, the next round coming up. And sometimes girls go out and promote for the boxers or the companies and things like that. So it's a lot of fun.
I'll tell you what. I guess, you know, everybody has these certain dreams to be champion of the world. Of course, everybody would dream they could date one of them little card girls up there. It's part of the youthful ambition.
There you go.
Stops with youth, huh?
Like they say, every man's got another limitations. I just want to meet her grandma, that's all.
As a promoter, self and otherwise, Jimmy Savedic acknowledges few limitations. He writes poetry. He stages not only Golden Gloves bouts, but quasi-theatrical productions. He may soon be promoting Ultimate Fighting, a competition that involves kicking as well as punching and hitting your opponent before he can get off the floor. One of Jimmy's many business cards identifies him as a public relations specialist, but the banner across the top of the card reads, Bail, USA. Despite the sometimes bewildering variety of his past and present pursuits, he clings to a few simple precepts.
Tell you what, I have never yet seen a kid, I lost count of people, I've never arrested a kid with boxing gloves. Okay, they can't be second story men, they can't steal your car, and it's really tough to sit there and smoke a crack pipe with a boxing glove on.
It's a rote endorsement of boxing, but Jimmy Savedic has the experience to back it up.
First kid I arrested 30-some years ago. His little Smith boy was 13 years old. It was funny because he was afraid and so was I. He'd grab a kid, he scared him, chased him. He was stealing tape deck from a car. So I grabbed him and a knot-and-ball boy. Both boys are dead now. Smith boy didn't make it till he was 15. He died from an overdose of drugs. And I always felt if I would have done something different. And I always felt maybe that boy will always be immortal to me. He will always be 13 years old for me, and I'll always be holding the back of his belt. And I wish I could have held his belt and dragged him to a gym. I didn't do that.
Hence the cramped premises at the corner of 3rd and Ross in Pittsburgh. Though none of the young men I met that afternoon in February had been dragged to the gym, they came because they believed they had talent and that work would refine that talent into the means for providing a living.
I want to be the light heavyweight champion in the world.
Aaron Soule, 25, has only been coming to Jimmy Savedic's gym for a couple of months, but he believes he'll be ready for a title fight within 5 years. I asked him how he'd come to that conclusion.
Probably because, you know, I tried a lot of other things in life that didn't work out too well, and this is just something that I happen to enjoy doing very much. I love the game of boxing, and just something I happen to be pretty good at.
Asked to assess Aaron Soule's chances, Jimmy Savedic falls back on one of his favorite slogans. He wants everybody in his place to strive to be the champion of his or her own life.
I've watched 1,000 young men come in here, and they dream, and some of them will never be boxers. It's just not going to happen. Not everybody can be a trainer, not everybody can be a announcer, not everybody can be a card girl. But everybody has to be the champion of their own life, because less than that is unacceptable. And that's what we do, build champions in life. And our motto is always for the kids. And that's so important. That's what we do.
Could you hear a little Don King in there? Maybe. King and Jimmy are both smiling in the picture of the two of them that hangs in the cafe. But in Pittsburgh, there are lots of kids and lots of people who are no longer kids who believe they're better off for having made the acquaintance of Jimmy Savedic. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view my boxing photo gallery, learn more about taking shots, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from boxer Bob Healy, who thinks about self-preservation.
We get to wear headgear as amateurs, so I'm kind of hoping maybe I'll just catch it in the nose and my brain will stay the same size.
This would seem to point out the need for boxing nose gear, don't you think? How about it, Everlast? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at DigitalLearning.MacFound.org.